Chapter 2. Desensitization and Pavlov's Dog at the Movies. Quote, I yelled, kill, kill, till I was hoarse. We yelled it as we engaged in bayonet and hand-to-hand combat drills. Then we sang about it as we marched. I want to be an airborne ranger. I want to kill the Viet Cong. I had stopped hunting when I was 16. I had wounded a squirrel. It looked up at me with its big, soft brown eyes as I put it out of its misery. I cleaned my gun and have never taken it out again. In 1969, I was drafted and very uncertain about the war. I had nothing against the Viet Cong, but by the end of basic training, I was ready to kill them. Jack, Vietnam veteran. Classical conditioning in the military. One of the most remarkable revelations in Watson's book, War on the Mind, is his report of conditioning techniques used by the U.S. government to train assassins. In 1975, Dr. Narut, a U.S. Navy psychiatrist with the rank of commander, told Watson about techniques he was developing for the U.S. government in which classical conditioning and social learning methodology were being used to permit military assassins to overcome their resistance to killing. The method used, according to Narut, was to expose the subjects to symbolic modeling involving films specially designed to show people being killed or injured in violent ways. By being acclimatized through these films, the men were supposed to eventually become able to disassociate their emotions from such a situation. Narut went on to say, the men were taught to shoot, but also given a special type of clockwork orange training to quell any qualms they may have about killing. Men are shown a series of gruesome films, which get progressively more horrific. The trainee is forced to watch by having his head bolted in a clamp so he cannot turn away, and a special device keeps his eyelids open. In psychological terms, this step-by-step reduction of a resistance is a form of classical Pavlovian conditioning called systematic desensitization. In the movie A Clockwork Orange, such conditioning was used to develop an aversion to violence by administering a drug that caused revulsion while the violent films were shown, until the revulsion became associated with the act of violence. In Commander Narut's real-world training, the nausea-creating drugs were left out, and those who were able to overcome their natural revulsion were rewarded, thereby obtaining the opposite effect of that depicted in Stanley Kubrick's movie. The U.S. government denies Commander Narut's claims, but Watson claims that he was able to obtain some outside corroboration from an individual who stated that Commander Narut had ordered violent films from him, and Narut's tale was subsequently published in the London Times. Remember that desensitization is a vital aspect of killing empowerment techniques used in modern combat training programs. The experience related by Jack at the beginning of this section is a sample of the desensitization and glorification of killing that has increasingly been a part of combat orientation. In 1974, when I was in basic training, we sang many such chants. One that was only a little bit more extreme than the majority was a running chant, with the emphasis shouted each time the left foot hit the ground. I want to rape, kill, pillage and burn, and eat dead babies. I want to rape, kill, pillage and burn. Our military no longer tolerates this kind of desensitization, but for decades it was a key mechanism for desensitizing and indoctrinating adolescent males into a cult of violence in basic training. Classical conditioning at the movies. If we believe that Commander Narut's techniques might work, and if we are horrified that the U.S. government might even consider doing such a thing to our soldiers, then why do we permit the same process to occur to millions of children across the nation? For that is what we are doing when we allow increasingly more vivid depictions of suffering and violence to be shown as entertainment to our children. It begins innocently with cartoons, and then goes on to the countless thousands of acts of violence depicted on TV as the child grows up, and the scramble for ratings steadily raises the threshold of violence on TV. As children reach a certain age, they then begin to watch movies with a degree of violence sufficient to receive a PG-13 rating due to brief glimpses of spurting blood, a hacked-off limb, or bullet wounds. Then the parents, through neglect or conscious decision, begin to permit the child to watch movies rated R, due to vivid depictions of knives penetrating and protruding from bodies, long shots of blood spurting from severed limbs, and bullets ripping into bodies and exploding out the back in showers of blood and brains. Finally, our society says that young adolescents, at the age of 17, can legally watch these R-rated movies, although most are well experienced with them by then. And at 18, they can watch the movies rated even higher than R. These are films in which eye gouging is often the least of the offenses that are vividly depicted. And thus, at that malleable age of 17 and 18, the age at which armies have traditionally begun to indoctrinate the soldier into the business of killing, American youth, systematically desensitized from childhood, takes another step into the indoctrination into the cult of violence. Adolescents and adults saturate themselves in such gruesome and progressively more horrific entertainment, whose anti-heroes like Hannibal the Cannibal, Jason and Freddy are sick, unkillable, unquestionably evil, and criminally sociopathic. They have nothing in common with the exotic, esoteric, and misunderstood Frankenstein and Wolfman villains of an earlier generation of horror films. In the old horror stories and movies, very real but subconscious fears were symbolized by mythic but unreal monsters, such as Dracula, and then exorcised by a stake through the heart. In contemporary horror, terror is personified by characters who resemble our next-door neighbor, even our doctor. Importantly, Hannibal the Cannibal, Jason and Freddy are not killed, much less exorcised. They return over and over again. Even in movies where the killer is not an obvious sociopath, the common formula is to validate violent acts of vengeance by beginning the movie with a vivid depiction of the villain performing horrible acts on some innocents. These victims are usually related in some way to the hero, thereby justifying the hero's subsequent and vividly depicted vigilante acts. Our society has found a powerful recipe for providing killing empowerment to an entire generation of Americans. Producers, directors, and actors are handsomely rewarded for creating the most violent, gruesome, and horrifying films imaginable. Films in which the stabbing, shooting, abuse, and torture of innocent men, women, and children are depicted in intimate detail. Make these films entertaining as well as violent, and then simultaneously provide the usually adolescent viewers with candy, soft drinks, group companionship, and the intimate physical contact of a boyfriend or girlfriend. Then, understand that these adolescent viewers are learning to associate these rewards with what they are watching. Powerful group processes often work to humiliate and belittle viewers who close their eyes or avert their gaze during these gruesome scenes. Adolescent peer groups reward with respect and admiration those who reflect Hollywood's standard of remaining hardened and undisturbed in the face of such violence. In effect, many viewers have their heads bolted in a psychological clamp so they cannot turn away, and social pressure keeps their eyelids open. Discussing these movies and this process in the psychology classes I taught at West Point and Arkansas State University, I repeatedly asked my students how the audience responds when the villain murders some innocent young victim in a particularly horrible way. And over again, their answer was, the audience cheers. Society is in a state of denial as to the harmful nature of this. But in efficiency, quality, and scope, it makes the puny efforts of Clockwork Orange and the U.S. government pale by comparison. We are doing a better job of desensitizing and conditioning our citizens to kill than anything Commander Nrut ever dreamed of. If we had a clear-cut objective of raising a generation of assassins and killers who are unrestrained by either authority or the nature of the victim, it is difficult to imagine how we could do a better job. In video stores, the horror section repeatedly displays bare breasts, often with blood running down them, gaping eye sockets, and mutilated bodies. Movies rated X with tamer covers are generally not available in many video stores, and if they are in separate adults-only rooms. But the horror videos are displayed for every child to see. Here, breasts are taboo if they are on a live woman, but permissible on a mutilated corpse? When Mussolini and his mistress were publicly executed and hung upside down, the mistress's dress flopped over her head to display her legs and underwear. One U.S. soldier in the crowd subsequently had the decency to walk up and tuck the corpse's dress between its legs in a show of respect for the dead woman. She may have deserved to die, but she did not deserve to be so degraded after death. Where did we lose this sense of propriety toward the dignity of death? How did we become so hardened? The answer to that question is that we, as a society, have become systematically desensitized to the pain and suffering of others. We may believe that tabloids and tabloid TV make us exceedingly conscious of the suffering of others as they spread the stories of victims. But the reality is that they are desensitizing us and trivializing these issues as each year they have to find increasingly more bizarre stories to satisfy their increasingly jaded audiences. We are reaching that stage of desensitization at which the inflicting of pain and suffering has become a source of entertainment, vicarious pleasure rather than revulsion. We are learning to kill, and we are learning to like it.